This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Gemara says in Sukkah Daf Nun Beis on a Beis. Nun Beis on an Aleph, in fact. A well-known statement that Kol HaGodol Michaveroi Yitzroi Godol Himenu. Whoever is greater than his friend has a greater Yetzer Hora. So the Gemara says, and everybody quotes it, as you get further in Yiddishkeit, as you get further in spirituality, as you reach newer and higher levels, so the Yetzer Hora becomes more and more difficult to handle. It becomes more and more of a challenge. It's not one of those things that one ever finally gets rid of. On the contrary, it strengthens as you go along. And many people talk about this statement and discuss it. I find it difficult to understand on its surface, because what does it mean that these great, great men, Vilna Gaon, the Chassidish Rabbein, Rabbi Akiva Eger, Hanoida B'Yehuda, Chassam Sofer, Rambam, Rashbo, Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Meir, Moshe Rabbeinu, go as far back as you want. Does it mean that they used to have bigger Yetzer Horas than we have? Is that what it means? So there are various different answers and explanations, and the most common one is, no, it doesn't mean that. It means that the Yetzer Hara is on a more sophisticated level. The Yetzer Hara goes up, their Yetzer Hara is not the same as ours as to whether to eat kosher, whether to eat treif, or whether to do this, or whether to do that. They have very sophisticated Yetzer Haras which are strong and powerful. That's a very nice pshat, it's a very nice explanation, but it's wrong. Everybody gives that explanation, but it's not right. Because if you look in the Gemara, which is the source of that statement of Kol HaGodol Michaveiro Yitzroi Godol Himenu, that the greater you are, the greater is your Yetzer Hara, and you see what prompts the Gemara to make that statement, you realize that such an interpretation is not valid. Omer Abaye says, Abaye uve Talmidei Chachomim Yoyser Mikulom. And a Talmid Chochem suffers from Yetzer Hara more than anybody. What kind of Yetzer Hara? Kihoda Abaye, this very case of Abaye. Shame lahau gavre de ka'omel lahai itete nakdim venezel be'uche. He heard a man saying to a lady who was not his wife one evening, let's get up very early tomorrow so that we can start going. We'll get into the car and we'll leave early in the morning before sunrise and we'll get onto the road. Omar said Abaye to himself, Ezil afreshinu miyisura. I'll go along too, so that I'll drive just behind them so that they're being watched, and it'll make it easier for them not to do anything they shouldn't do. Ozo batrayu tlata parsi, dagma. He followed them for 3 parsos, a long way. He followed them down the road. Kihavu parshi mi'adodi, when they came to crossroads and they were going to separate from each other, Shaminu, he heard them say, the Kramri, they were saying, Urchin rechike, v'tsavtin besimo. The way is long, but the company is nice. In other words, you've got to go to the right and I've got to go to the left, and it's way out of each other's way. We can't go together, although it would have been so nice to continue in each other's company. Sorry, we can't, and goodbye, and off they go. Omer Abaye, says Abaye, Iman desani li have. If my hated one was there, that means my Yetzirah, lo yave matzid l'ukmenashe, I wouldn't have been able to do that. I would have fallen for it. Abaye! Do you know who that is? Looks at a poshet of balabos with a woman, and he stands in absolute admiration. He can't understand. So let's get away from all these sophisticated answers. It means higher Yetzer Horas and all that. It's not. It's the same Yetzer Hora. The Yetzer Hora to do the same things, the same normal human impulses that anybody's got, A Talmid Chochem has two, and if he doesn't, he's not normal. And he has them in much greater quantities and with much greater intensity than an ordinary person. That's what it is. Abaya stands and looks at an ordinary person in a normal social encounter. Two people traveling together, and they travel from here to somewhere or other, and then they go their own ways, and Abaya said, if I was there, wouldn't have been able to separate from it. Very strange. Ozal tolo nafshe biiburu d'dashu amitzdaya. He couldn't stand up straight anymore. He got such a chalishus hadas, he was so upset when he saw the disparity of self-control between this ordinary person and himself. He just went to the doorpost and he leant to the doorpost and he put his hand on his forehead and he was broken. Ata hau saba, an old man came to him and saw what he was worried about. Tanalei, and he taught him, he learnt with him. Kola godol mechaveira yitzve godol emine. Don't worry, Abaya, don't think it's because you're a nobody that you wouldn't have been able to withstand that pressure. It's because you're a somebody. The greater you are, the greater is the Yetzirah, not the other way around. So again, let's not try and pretend that the Gemara means something that it doesn't. The Gemara means quite simply that whatever normal human impulses drive ordinary people to averos, those same human impulses are found in Talmidei Chachomim with greater intensity and in greater quantity. That's what it means. What we're going to discuss this evening is why and what to do about it. From the Tzal Yoko, where the Gemara says, where the Chumash says in this week's Sedra, that whatever the Chachomim tell you to do, you must do. Also, you mustn't depart from what they tell you to do. Your minute tomorrow, not to the left or to the right. Al pi atoyro asher yoruchu v'al hamishpat asher yomer l'cho ta'aseh. Do the Torah that they teach you and the law that they say to you. Lo yisosu min adover asher yagidu l'cho yomer l'smol, then depart from what they tell you left or right. Says Rashi, the famous Rashi, based on the Gemara in Sanhedrin, afilo oymer l'cho al yomin shu smol v'al smol shu yomin v'chol shem k'shomer l'cho al yomin v'al smol smol. Even if the Talmid Chochem is telling you about your right hand that it's in fact your left hand and that your left hand is your right hand, in other words, is telling you something you know is clearly not so, you still have to act in accordance with his instructions against your better judgment. That's what the mitzvah of Lois Sosur is. And we mentioned the Kleyoka last night, which develops an idea that the Ramban starts. That is, ask the Kleyoka, how is that possible? How is it feasible that you've got to listen to a Talmid Chochem or to anybody, but even a Talmid Chochem who tells you something which is absolutely, definitely wrong? Why should you listen to something wrong? Says the Kleyoka, nothing is absolutely, definitely wrong. Everything in the world has two sides to it. It's a little bit of right, a little bit of wrong, depends on the circumstances, depends how you look at it, depends who's looking at it, how you analyze it. Everything is a mixture of right and wrong. Everything is a mixture of good and bad. Everything is a mixture of black and white. It's not black or white. Every shaila has two sides to it. Every sofek, every doubt has two sides to it. Every din has two sides to it. And many more than two sides to it. Not, there's no absolute clarity. You can't just say this is black, this is white, this is awesome, this is mutter. You can't do it. It's just a matter of weighing up the pros and the cons. And figuring out at the end, on balance, what is the correct thing to do. And that's what a She'elas Chochem is. When one comes to a Chochem to ask him a Shaila, that's what he goes through. Works out all the sides in favor and all the sides against, and he balances them. Not quantitatively, because that wouldn't help. He balances them up qualitatively. You might have 1.4 and 20 points against, you'll go 4. Because the 0.4 is a much bigger one. And that depends on the circumstances. That's why different Shailas are passed in different ways in different circumstances. Of the elements change. Shall we say that relative weightiness of the elements change in different circumstances, and that's what the Talmid Chochem is busy weighing up. And that's why the Talmid Chochem is the most qualified person to ask general advice in Midi Alma as well, just in ordinary matters too. Because he's used to the process of weighing up dozens of different factors and aspects and figuring it as the Kleyoka. When the Talmid Chochem tells you that this is your right, it's not 100% wrong. Really what he's telling you is that you must treat this as your right hand or yours, your left hand, whatever the case may be. It's not 100% wrong. It might be 99% wrong. Or it might be 90% wrong or 80% wrong, but it's not 100% wrong because there's nothing which is 100%. That means under these circumstances, he considers that that 1% truth in what he's telling you is in these circumstances worth more than the 99% on the other side, and that you have to follow it. Particularly with his authority behind that, that 1% plus his authority is enough to tip the scales. That's how the Klei Yochel explains the din, that you have to follow the Chachomim even if they tell you to do something which is right against your better judgment. And to do that, need shofar shochet. So what needs to stop this? If we're going to have situations, if we recognize that life is such a delicate balancing, if we realize that there's no such thing as right and wrong, but everything is a mixture of right and wrong, that's what happened after the sin of Adam Harishon. Before Adam Harishon, everything was clear, right, wrong, finished. After Adam Harishon, everything was up. And if that's the case, that we're living in a circumstance where every decision that we take, everything we view, every analysis we engage in is so complex and consists of so many dozens of points for and against, we need shofti. We need people who are trained to make decisions. Otherwise we'll go crazy. We'll start thinking of the pros and cons of everything. We'll go meshuga. One needs a shofet, one needs a rov to be able to say, I've worked through it, I've considered all the pros, I've considered all the cons, and under the circumstances, the best thing for you to do, or the right thing for you to do, is A. There is truth, by the way, absolutely. When a Rav comes with his psak, that psak is binding 100%. Then all the pros and cons no longer apply. So when everything is very confused, and everything is very heavy, and everything is very doubtful, you need shofti. Which is the name of the Sedra. What's the warning that the shoftim are given? Loi tikach sheichad, ki ha-sheichad ye'aver enei chachomim. The judges mustn't take bribery because bribery blinds the eyes of chachomim. What does that mean? Let's get an idea of what kind of bribery you're not allowed to take. There's some gemaras in Kesubas that kuf hei amud beis, which we've done before in the shir. Tanu Rabbonin, we learnt in a braisa, v'shoichad lo tikach, and you mustn't take bribery. Eino tzorich lo ma shoichad momon. That doesn't, obviously that means financial bribery is included. That's clear you're not allowed to take financial bribery. Elo afilu shoichad devorim nami osur. But even verbal bribery you're not allowed to take. And the Gemara says, and Rashi brings it, that this shochad is not only bribery to judge incorrectly, but even bribery, afilu says Rashi, lishpot tzedek. Even to judge correctly, you're not allowed to take bribery. In other words, if a man comes to you and says, look, I would like you to know how much I appreciate that you have been allocated as the judge. Please treat me with no special favors. Decide the case on its merits only, and you will have my full backing and support for whatever your judgment and decision is. And as a sign of my gratitude, here is a check for 100 grand. Can't do. Not only that, but even Shaykhad Dvorim, even if he's given you verbal bribery, and he's not asking you to do him any favors, just verbal bribery, you still can't sit on the case. He held the Shmuel, for example, the case of Shmuel, have Ova B'Mavra. He was crossing a bridge, and the bridges in those days were a bit rickety. It was a man who came and gave him a hand, just helped him across the bridge a little bit. He said, what's up with you? What are you doing with yourself? He said, as a matter of interest, a case is coming up. Shmuel was the dayan of the town. That meant a case is coming up in your Beis Din. I'm occupied with a case which is coming up. Said Shmuel, Omale. Patil nulach ledina. Well, I must recuse myself. You've just disqualified me to sit on the case. Just by giving me the hand as I was walking over the bridge. Shmuel, what's he worried about? A man who learns, a man who is a godel b'torah, not in our generation, but in their generation. A man who can subject himself absolutely and can master himself and can do exactly what he wants and knows how not to do what he doesn't want to do. Such a man, Shmuel, we're talking in the, during the Shalosh Shudos of greatness of one or two generations ago. Shmuel was in the time of the Amoraim and he was one of the greatest of his generation. What's Shmuel worried about? It because the man helps him over the bridge, he's going to be dishonest. That Shmuel is going to make a mistake, that he's going to find in favor of the man. Amemer Avi Yativ, Amemer was sitting the Kodoyim dinner and he was sitting in court, Porach Gadfo Aresha, and a little bird sat on his head. Ata how Gavra Shakle, so a man came and just took the bird off his head. Omale Maya Vizitech, he said to the man, What are you doing here? What's going on? Omale Dina Itri, he said, well, as it happens, court case coming up, I'm waiting for my turn. Omale Pasilna Lakhludina. He said, I can't judge. You've done that for me, I can no longer paskin for you. My psak won't be accurate. Unbelievable. Rabbi Yishmael but Rabbi Yossi have a regular risid of a maiselekel malishabte kanta de peri. Rabbi Yishmael but Rabbi Yossi had an oris. An oris is a manager. They used to have orchards and farms, and they used to employ managers on a profit sharing basis. The oris would come in and work the farm and give the balabos, for example, 2/3 of the income, and he would keep 1/3 of the income. That was the arrangement they used to have. He was a farm manager. And every Friday, the Oris used to bring Rabbi Yishmael but Rabbi Yossi a basket of fruit for Shabbos. That was the arrangement. It was used to go on like that. Yom Echad Aitilei Behei B'Shabbos. One day, the fruit arrived on Thursday instead of Friday. So you or I wouldn't have commented. Wouldn't have even noticed it, probably. Omalei Maishna Ha'idna. Rabbi Yishmael but Rabbi Yossi picked up that something's different. It's not, he's so well tuned. And just look at the high tuning of these gedolim. Picks up immediately, something's changed, something's happened. And he asks, "Ma nishtana? Why is this week different from all other weeks?" Amale dina itli, he said, I'm busy with a court case. Vamina agavurchi aitile lemar. And I thought, while I'm busy getting ready for the court case, I'll drop it in at your house. Loi kabil mine. Firstly, he didn't accept the fruit. Secondly, Omale Pasilna Lach Ludin. Secondly, he recused himself. Even though he didn't accept the fruit, he still recused himself from the test. Rabbi Yishmael but Rabbi Yossi. Otiv Zuzud Rabbon and the Kadainin and Leh. So he brought up another pair of Tzami the Chachomim to judge the case. Hadi the Ka'ozil, the Ati, the Kadainin and Leh, they were judging. But Hadi the Ka'ozil, the Ati, as they were going, and wherever he was going, Omar, he was saying to himself, Iboi Toin Hachi. Having heard the details of the case, he was occupying his mind, wherever he found himself walking, with what the Oris, the claimant there, his own manager, could claim in court. He became fascinated with the case, and he was working like the guy's lawyer. He was working out all the possible claims that he could do if he's clever. Omar, all of a sudden, he stopped himself. And he realized what would have been happening if he was one of the judges. What he's sitting and doing is not figuring out what the other man can claim. All that's going through his mind all the time is what his oris could claim. Amar tipach nafsham shel mekablei shoychat. Curses, a curse be all those who take bribery. Uma ani shel lo natalti. I, who didn't even take bribery. Ve'in natalti sheli natalti. And if I would have taken it, I was taking my own. Who does the fruit belong to? It's my fruit. I wasn't even taking bribery, even if I would have taken it. And I find my mind totally preoccupied with trying to work out the case of this man. Can you imagine what would be going on in my mind if I had received bribery? Now you must also bear in mind that in those days, even the corrupt people were at least honest. So that if a man receives bribery, it considered it his duty to do the job properly. And today you can pay a person a bribe and he still does nothing for you. That there was no question about then. If you did bribe him, he worked for you, and you see how he worked. Rabbi Yishmael wasn't even paid the bribe, and if he would have been paid the bribe, it was his money. And look how he's working. And he says, my goodness, and if I had received the bribe, says Rashi on the Chumash, Misha kibel shochad mimenu. Once a man receives bribery from him, listen to the words carefully. E'efsha, it is impossible. Rashi is talking about dayonim of this stature, of Shmuel, of Rabbi Yishmuel, the Amoraim, the Tanoim, anybody, the highest of the high, people of this caliber. E'efsha, that's not possible. That he won't pay more attention to the one who gave him the bribe in order to try and find something in his favor. Not possible. That's a statement, a psychological fact. That once you've received the bribe, it is not possible that you won't pay a little bit more attention to the man who paid you the bribe. Says the Gemara, why is that? Also the Gemara on the same daf in Ksubas daf Kufhe. Omar Rove, my time of the Shuchtet. Why is bribery no good? What does bribery do? Answers Rove, Kivan de Kabil le Shuchte mine. Once you've received bribery from him, Ikrevo le Date le Gabe, you become close to him, the Havi ke Gufe, and you become part of him. You're like one body. The ein odom roye chovel atzma, and a person doesn't find wrong with himself. That's what Rava says is the principle of bribery. You become like one person, and you don't find anything wrong with yourself. Just to deviate for a moment, that's an amazing thing, because look what one can do if one uses bribery positively. All you have to do is a little bit of bribery, and you become like one person with the other. You're trying to build a friendship. And I've said many times, don't find yourselves involved in friendships with people who want to be your friends. Because people who want to be your friends have got nobody better than you. That's to do the best they can make. So they're not suitable to be your friends. You find friends who don't want to be your friends because you're not good enough for them. Those are the people you should be after. Like as one of the Marx brothers said, that he wouldn't be a member of any club that was prepared to have him as a member. Be insulted to be a member of a club that's prepared to have him. Don't be a friend of somebody who's prepared to be your friend. You go after friends who are not prepared. It's one of the tragedies of social life, that by neglect and by maybe pride, people generally find themselves with a social set that is well below them. Just because those are the people that happen to be hanging around, they're the people who happen to have time, they're the nudniks, they're the unsuccessful people, they're the people who can't make it with any better friends, so they're the ones who hang around, and that's who you get landed with. Don't do that. The Mishnah says, Kenelecho Chaver. Go and buy yourself a friend. You don't sit and wait. If you want to buy a car, you don't sit and wait until somebody comes and offers you one for nothing. Because if he offers you one for nothing, there's something wrong with it, and it's worth nothing, and you wouldn't take it. Imagine a person comes and says, oh, you're looking for a car? Well, look, you can have mine. It's on a dump outside town. You can have it for nothing. Take it. You wouldn't be interested in it. You'll go and you'll read up on what the cars available are in your price range, and you'll test drive them, and you'll go after the one you choose you want. And if you can't get it, you'll go from one shop to the other shop to the other shop, and you'll persuade them, it's got to be that one. You've decided. That's the car for you. But there's not one available. Doesn't matter. You'll wait, and you'll be most nefesh, and you'll pay a little bit more for it, and you'll drive for it. You'll get the car you want. That's kanei. When you want to buy something, you first choose what you want, and then you go after it. And you don't take no for an answer. Mishnah says, Kenei lecho chaver, go and buy friends. Don't sit at home waiting for them to drop in for tea. Those are the friends who've got nothing better to do. Throw them out, so to say. Don't be inhospitable, please, everybody. You shouldn't take me too literally. But those aren't the people that have to become your friends. You have to be nice to them because they're miserable people, and there's a din of chesed. So you show them kindness and you show them understanding. Like a poor man comes to your house and he needs charity, you give him charity. And if a miserable person comes to your house and he needs company, you give him a bit of company. But comes a time when enough is enough and you tell him to go out. But a chaver, somebody you're going to get involved with, somebody you're going to share experiences with, somebody you're going to share learning with, somebody you're going to discuss with, somebody you're going to go out to the theatre with, somebody you're going to get close to. Don't wait for them to drop in on you. You go after the ones you want. And if they don't want you, as they shouldn't, canay, buy them, bribe them. And Rabbeinu Yonah says that means, if necessary, with cash, if you have to. Quite mercenary. And it's using the principle of shoychat. That's one of the things that cash can do. It can make you like one. It can make two people like one. Spend a bit of money on your friends. If that's what you want, you're prepared to spend money on your car. And you're prepared to spend money on your dog. And you're prepared to spend money on your horse and your cat. And you're prepared to spend money on your garden and your garden boy and your servants and your house. But on your friends, you spend money on your friends. They're not poor. They don't need you. Then you'll end up with the kind of friends you deserve. If friends are as important to you as a motor car is, at least, and they're important to you as your cat is, and your dog is, and your mice are, then go and buy, spend money on them. Look after them. Invest in friends. If you can do it without money, that's fine, but you've got to invest something. You won't make friends without investing anything. Invest effort, invest time, invest thoughtfulness. And even, says Rabbeinu Yonah, invest cash. And we see from the Gemara why. Because once you've taken sheikhah, what does Rava say here? One's mind becomes joined to him. One becomes intellectually bonded. And more than that, and you become like one person. And people don't like to see bad to themselves. And so you'll find all of a sudden your friend defends you, and he won't listen to any lashon hara about you, and it just cost you a few rand. That's all it was. But one has to keep it up. It becomes expensive after a while, but it's worth it. It doesn't say that, as a matter of interest, about a rav. Kanei lecha chaver, but what does it say? Asei lecha rav. Don't try buying a rabbi. Because then you're bribing him. And when you have a rav, what you want is truth. And that you won't get with money. That gets spoiled by money. If you want truth, it's got to be pure. But that, you don't want truth from a friend. You want society. You want companionship. You want to be together. You want closeness. For that you can pay. Doesn't matter, it won't harm the friendship. But where it's a rav, it's asei lecha rav. You've got to make yourself a rav in ways other than bribery. Now that we understand the principles of shochad and the power of shochad, let's just take it one step further. The Yetzer Hara is often compared to shochad, to bribery. How does shochad operate? Why would Shmuel not sit at that case? And why would Rabbi Yishmael Bar Yossi not sit at that case? And why does Rava say that? What is Rava worried about? So you become like one, and you ein adam roye chove la'atzmo. A man doesn't see anything wrong with him. What happens? Says the Pasuk, Ki ha-shoichad ye'aver einei chachomim. A chochum's greatness lies in his perception, in what he sees. He's able to see all the millions of different connotations to every problem. That's what makes him different to the namoritz, to the man in the street. A namoritz, if you'll ask him a shayla, you'll say, may I put on the lights on Shabbos? He'll say, no. Paskin, you'll paskin right. What kind of an Amaoritz is he, you'll ask, if he knows the din? To him, there's no shaila, it's clear that you can't. Because there are only two sides, turning on the light, not turning on the light. One is an Aveda, one isn't, so you can't turn on the light. Finished, he sees two sides to it. The Talmid Chacham will think very carefully before he answers that question. And you'll say, why do you want to put on the light? What is the circumstance? Why do you need light in the room? Who are you? What's your background? Where do you come from? And as you'll be talking to him, his mind will be ticking over and millions of variations start creeping in. And he has to start weighing up and what to be Amaoret is a simple shaila, to the Talmid Chochem is not so simple at all. And each thing he's asked, unless it's a stupid question obviously, any intelligent question he's asked, he weighs up and he works out and he figures. all these ramifications weighing until he comes to a final decision. That's how it's got to be. So his brilliance is in his perception. When a Talmid Chacham has to find a heter, for example, you come to a Talmid Chacham and you say, I need to put on the light. I have a problem. I need to put on the light. Can you allow it? The Amaoris will say, no. Can't put on the light. The Talmid Chacham starts and he says, no, you can't put on the light. However, if it's this, maybe you can. But since it's only that, you can't. But on the other hand, if we can find this, then again you can. And he'll work and work and work and work until he finds one thing which can just tip the scale. Enough for him to say, yes, okay, you can. Or to say, sorry, I've worked and worked and worked and I can't tip the scale away. That's what the Talmid Chacham works on. And the Gemara actually says that to be machmir, to say no to a question, you don't have to be a rov. Anybody can say no. Anybody can say trace, and anybody can say osu. We call it hayra'a, we call it psak and paskening, really. Only when you're finding a heter, which is obviously a legally valid and a halachically acceptable heter. That's the art of psak. To work and work and find that you can find good halachic reason just to tip the balance in order to enable somebody to do something that he needs to do within the framework of halach. Imagine that the chacham is figuratively blind. Imagine he hasn't got such good perception. He's dead. He's not a Talmid Chacham. It's like a gymnast who has no arms, or a musician who's deaf, or a painter who's blind. The tools of his trade are missing. His whole thing is in perception. His whole gadlus lies in perception. The moment his perception loses its clarity, he's no longer a Chacham. And that's what we're told about bribery. Ki ha-shoychad ye'aver einei chachomim. Bribery blinds the chacham. It damages his perception. And that's dangerous, because now it means that in every shaila he doesn't see all the ramifications. And if he misses some ramifications, his psak will be incorrect, his decision will be wrong. And that's the biggest danger of all. Why? Says Rava, because ein adam roye chovel la'atzmo. Man comes and gives you the gift, he gives you the 100 rand, or he gives you a basket of flowers or fruit or whatever it is, and then you have to decide something for him, between him and somebody else. You're at one with him, and you won't want to find against him like you won't want to find against you. What does that mean? Try taking a needle. When you get home, try it. Go to your wife's sewing machines, or if you're ladies, go to your own sewing machine, and take out a nice thick needle from there. And if you want to, you can stick it in Dettol or something. Just clean it up. And put out your arm and stab yourself with it. You won't do it. You shouldn't. People don't hurt themselves. Go to a doctor and he does it doesn't bother you. But people won't do it to themselves. Why not? It's an inherent preserving nature of humanity, of life. If people damage themselves, they might kill themselves. Suicide is an abnormality. No matter what the pressure is, it's an abnormality. People don't do that kind of thing, no matter how desperate they are, unless something clicks and goes wrong. People don't hurt themselves deliberately. Only sick people do that. And that's something inbred into the human being, so as to preserve him. Says Rava, once you feel close to another person, damaging him is as sick as damaging you. It's just not normal. So you wouldn't stick the needle into yourself, so get your best friend and stick the needle into him. You wouldn't do it either. There's a tendency to move away from doing anything harmful to yourself. That's what it is. Let's now move to general cases of the Yetzer Hara. I'm going to introduce you to the Yetzer Hara tonight. It's good to know what he looks like, because when you know what he looks like, then you can deal with him a little bit more effectively. I think part of the problem with the Yetzer Hara is we don't know what he looks like. You know, Tzaro Shel Esav, the Yetzer Hara was the angel of Esav, and you remember when Yaakov fought with that angel, what did he say at the end of the battle? He said, what's your name, by the way? What did the angel answer? Don't ask such detailed questions, just forget about my name. The Yetzer Hara is best off when we can't identify him. As long as we haven't defined him and we don't see him clearly, that's when he can operate the best. He starts losing effectiveness once you can point your finger at him and you know who he is. So let's meet him tonight. Let's get him into the room here, and we're going to put him right up there on top, on the bookcase. We'll stand him up, and you can all have a jolly good look at him, so that next time you see him, you'll know him, and you'll know how to handle him, and you'll know how he works. We'll understand him at the end of all this. What's the Yetzer Hara? Why don't I damage my body? Because I see my body as a means to instant and direct gratification and pleasure. That's it. My body enables me to do what I want. Go and damage that which gives me what's nice. That's sick. That's crazy. Likewise, when somebody is being bribed, he sees that other person as a potential source of gratification. And he becomes kegufoy, like his body. They don't become spiritually intertwined necessarily. When you've bribed your friend with money, it doesn't mean that you're spiritual friends yet. That takes a long time to develop. But you're physical friends immediately. Because he sees you, thinks to himself, look, he's not exactly the kind of guy I like mixing with. But I can't deny that it's nice. I can't deny that I benefit from it. That's how you start with buying a friend. And hopefully as the relationship develops, he'll find that even without the money it's good, and that after all you have got something to contribute to the relationship, and so the relationship will develop. But what's important is that at the initial stages he says to himself, look, although that's not my kind of friend, it's nice. I get what I want through it. It creates a nice feeling. I have gratification through it. I feel good as a result of it. And he starts feeling about you as he feels about his own body. Now, normal people, spiritual people, are not in love with their own bodies. And they don't regard their own bodies as the best kind of companionship. But they have a very good working relationship with their bodies, and they don't do any harm. They don't cause any harm to their bodies. And if they're good, they even look after them. So if you've bribed a friend, if you've been koine achaver, if you've purchased a friend, you can be sure that how much in love with you he is not terribly important, but he's going to treat you well. And he's going to find you a source of his gratification and will respect you and preserve you as such. That he'll do. The Yetzer Hara operates on the same basis. The Yetzer Hara results from your respect and your need and your desire for immediate gratification. That's all. It's nice. And you don't want to do any harm to that which brings you immediate gratification. That's where the Yetzer Hara makes his money. That's how he operates. That's how his business works. What does he do? What do you do when you would have to damage yourself? How do you justify not damaging yourself? You just don't look clearly. Let's say you have to go running. The doctor tells you must go running twice a day. And you don't like going running. It damages the source of your instant gratification. Even though it brings you long-term gratification, maybe, but as far as your instant gratification is concerned, it's no good to go running. What do? You don't listen to the doctor clearly, that's all. You don't understand what he's telling you absolutely. You leave out a few points in your mind. That's all you need. And then you say, what did he tell me? I must go because it's good for me. There are many other things that are good for me too, and there's limited time, and I'll do something else instead. He didn't hear the doctor say, that's the only thing that's good for you. He just left out the word only, and he forgot about it. He didn't hear it. He's blind. His eyesight is beginning to fade. There are one or two points that he doesn't see, and that leads him to take decisions which are entirely wrong. You know, when you're playing this little balancing trick, and the balance is just there, and most things are just there. There are not many things that are black or white, don't forget. Most things are just in balance. One factor you're blind to, one factor you don't see, and the balance tips the wrong way. And what causes you not to see? A desire not to hurt yourself. That's all. So now I'll tell you something quite shattering. The Yetzer Hara, there he is. Can you see him? Can't see him. He's not there. because he doesn't exist. It's blindness, that's all. The Yetzer Hara is just a little bit of confusion. The Yetzer Hara is the absence of something, not the presence of something. It's a gap, it's a hole. It's just not seeing something that you should be seeing. That's the Yetzer Hara. This big monster we've created. When I said I was going to put him up there on the shelf, you wondered how he would fit there. Because in your mind he was so huge, you didn't know how he would fit into the room, you never mind how he was going to stand there like a little pitch killer. He doesn't need to fit there. He couldn't fit there because he doesn't exist. There is no such thing. They're just people who like to be comfortable, and that causes them to have black spots in their vision. And those black spots, they are the Yetzer Hara. And they're not spots. It's not that there's a spot on your eye and you can remove the spot. It's just that your eye isn't looking well enough, that's all. You're not wide awake. Your eyes aren't open sufficiently. And that's why we make such a mess of fighting the Yetzer Hara. We get dressed in our armor, and we put on our helmets, and we take out our cannons, our huge elephant guns, and off we go to hunt the Yetzer Hara. And we start shooting all over the place, wildly, shooting. We kill a few people in the process, we kill ourselves sometimes in the process, a lot of damage gets done. And the Yetzer Hara, if he would exist, would be laughing. Joking, look at them going out to fight me. He doesn't exist. You don't need any guns to fight him. What do you need? You need to open your eyes, that's all. You need to look carefully. The Gemara says in Soto, Ein Odom Chote Elohim Kein Nichnas Boi Ruach Shtus. A man only sins if he goes mad. Every time you do an Avera, you're a little bit crazy. Because if you were normal, you would never do it. If your eyes were open and you were normal, you would never do it. The trouble is, mostly our eyes are a little bit closed. The things we don't want to see, we don't see. And that's what causes us to go so cockeyed and so wrong. But if we would just see all the factors clearly, if all the factors would be there on our scale while we're weighing them up and we wouldn't take out the ones that it suits us not to have there, we would see everything clearly and decisions would be obvious. I'll come to the method of fighting the Yetzer Hara in one moment, but let's first just answer the question with which we started. Michael, do you think you could open that window? Thanks. Why kol ha-godol mi-chaveiro yitzroi godol himen? Why is it that this simple man and this simple lady who Abaya were watching could handle their circumstance with ease, and Abaya felt he couldn't? What is it? It's really very simple. The Poshet HaMa'oretz is going out with this girl, and he says to himself, should I touch her, shouldn't I? I would like to, but I may not. Finished. End of the story. And if he's brought up that way, and he has a bit of emunah, and a bit of belief in the Ribono Shel Olam, it's not a very difficult decision to take. The din is no, that's all. Abaya is not on that level. That's not how he operates. It starts, the little pitch killer that starts is the desire to have a little bit of fun, to have something nice, to have some gratification. And deep, deep down, it's a little thing that just sets it all off. What does that set off? A little bit of blindness. Now when Abaya starts weighing up the question of can I touch this girl or not, he sees 500 reasons why he should and 600 reasons why he shouldn't, let's say. And he starts working on all these reasons. And he starts going through that. And that's a Tanu Chochem. Now, Amoritz is one reason why he should and one reason why he shouldn't. It must be a pleasure to be an Amoritz. The life is so simple, so easy. As one gets on and one learns a little bit, it starts becoming more and more complex. So this Shia Bayer sitting there, and he figures out 600, 400 reasons why I should and 600 reasons why I shouldn't. And then he starts analyzing. And he finds it's not 600 reasons why he shouldn't, it's really only 599, because that 600th one doesn't apply in these circumstances. And so he goes and he works and he works, and finally comes out it's only 400 against 401. And he works a little bit more to see, after all, one has to clarify the shaila. Now it's getting a big shaila. Now it's a major thing. 404 and only 401 against. That means that maybe I have to have relationships with her. Maybe it's a mitzvah. It's only one away. Let me think this through terribly carefully. And he thinks and he thinks of his mispalot to the Ribono Shel Olam to help him pass it right. Oh, and as he finishes his tefillah, he realizes he's absolutely right. That 401 also doesn't apply. It's now equal, 400 against 400. Now what? Ooh, now there's a major responsibility on him. And he works, and he works, and he works. And says Rashi, E'evshar, it's not possible, sheloy yates levovoy etloy lahafech bischusoy, that he won't turn his heart to the one he wants to, just to find that one point in favor. Because instant gratification comes first. That's what we like best. And if we can find kosher instant gratification, that's the best that there can be. And Abaye wouldn't think of trefa instant gratification. But he's now beginning to wonder, maybe this is kosher. Maybe it's a mitzvah, in fact. And so it's more difficult for the Yetzer Hara to operate with an Amoritz. Because with an Amoritz, he identifies the Yetzer Hara, he sees the Yetzer Hara, and he kicks the Yetzer Hara out. It's not that difficult. But at Talmid Chochem, you don't see the Yetzer Hara. He's not there. There is no such thing. It's what you don't see that is the problem when you're a Talmid Chochem, not what you do see. And you can't be aware of what you're not seeing. It's blindness, and you don't know when you're blind. We're talking about partial blindness. We're talking about just not noticing a little spot in the whole painting. You can come, you can have two people look at a Van Gogh. One's an Amoritz and one's a Talmid Chochem in painting. And you hear them talking about it afterwards, and what you think they're talking about two different paintings. And you find in the end that the difference is that the Amoritz didn't notice one thing about the painting, but that changes the whole interpretation of the whole thing. He just missed it. That's how it is with Shochet. When you have a requirement, when you have a need for some instant gratification, there's certain things that you don't see that are tiny. But in these matters, tiny things are vitally important. And that's what he misses. That's what he doesn't notice. And he doesn't even know that he doesn't notice them. And that's why by Talmid Chochem, the Yetzer Hara is so much greater. It's not greater because the man's much bigger. He doesn't exist in any case. It's greater because the weighing up process is so much more delicate. It's so much more finely balanced that one little mistake makes a major difference in the final decision. And the Yetzer Hara can have a field day with the Talmid Chochem because of the delicate tuning of the balances. So we started off with the principle that there's no absolute black and white, right and wrong. Everything's a bit of a mixture. We then developed the idea of Shochad, the extent of Shochad. Even little things can do it. The principle of Rova, that Shochad basically makes you see the other person as a source of gratification, just as your own body is a source of gratification. And just as you won't hurt yourself, because you are a source of gratification for yourself, so you wouldn't like to hurt anybody else who is a source of gratification for you. And that's how the Yetzer Hara wants it, that operates. In order for you not to, you see certain things as sources for your gratification, and as a result of that you become blind to certain elements. And that blindness means that there are things that you're not seeing. And it's what you're not seeing which is the Yetzer Hara. The Yetzer Hara is the absence of something, not the existence of something. And therefore it's terribly wrong to fight the Yetzer Hara. By the way, I should just read you a little medrash, in case you think this is very novel and original. Amar Rabbi Abba, said Rabbi Abba, a long time before this Motzei Shabbos. Hayetzer hazeh, this Yetzer Hara, Doime, I'll tell you what it looks like. So we went a step further, we had him in the room. Rabbi Abba is just going to describe him. Lelisti, that sounds very different to the Shir, he's a robber. Shofuf, with a brent back and broken legs and old. Shehoye Yoshev b'fashas drochim, sitting at the crossroads. There's this old, ancient robber, decrepit and broken and sick, sitting on a box at the crossroads. Whenever anybody passed there, he said, your money or your life. And people used to fork out. They used to pay. One pikeach came past. What's a pikeach? A pikeach is a wise man. That we say in the morning, the bracha of pikeach ivrim. Right? An open-eyed man came along. A man with eyes in his head came along. And he saw that this old man doesn't have the strength to steal anything from him. So he started beating this man. Etc. And so the The Midrash goes on to say that for several generations, the Yetzer Hara destroyed generation after generation until Avram came along and realized, what is it after all? It's nothing. And that's probably the meaning of that old Midrash of Avram bashing the idols in. It wasn't just the idols he was bashing in. He was demonstrating that the things that motivated them, the things by which they operated and lived, are really not the big gods they make them out to seem. They're really easily eliminated. And so says Rabbi Abba, what's the Yetzer Hara? Yeah, it's a big robber, sure, but you don't need any elephant guns. You can just take a little stick and you'll kill him. He's an old, decrepit robber. He can't do anything. So there we see again the concept that the Yetzer Hara is an illusion. It's not something that's really there. The Gemara in Sukkah, in fact, says as well, that same Gemara that we started off with, that Lasid Lavo Meviya HaKadosh Baruch Hu Yetzer Hara V'Shoftei B'fnei HaTzadikim V'fnei HaRishayim. One day in the future, the Ribbono Shel Olam is going to take the Yetzer Hara and he's going to shecht him in front of the Tzadikim and the Rishayim. Tzadikim Nidme Elohim Kahar Gavoya. The Tzadikim are going to look at the Yetzer Hara and they're going to say, my goodness, that cheap lepen, he told me that it didn't exist. Look at it, it's like a mountain. With a shame, and the wicked men, Nidme Elohim Kichutasara, they're going to say, my goodness, we thought all this time that the Yetzer Hara was such a big thing, so we didn't even bother taking it on. But it's nothing, it's like a little thread, it's nothing, it has no strength. Halalu Boichin, Valalu Boichin, they both start crying. All the Tzadikim will cry, and all the Rishoyim will cry. Tzadikim Boichin, Vayimim, Heich Yacholnu Lichboish Har Gavoya Kaze. The Tzadikim will look at this mountainous monster, and they'll be crying with the thrill that they actually managed to conquer it, and the wonder and the relief that they didn't fall before it. They didn't realize how big it was. Had they realized, they maybe wouldn't have ever have taken it on. The wicked ones also crying, how could we have conquered this little thing? It's a nothing, it's a garnet. So I ask you, what is it? Is it a mountain or is it a garnet? The answer is, it's a garnet. But what a garnet! There's a garnet and there's a garnet. You know the story of the rabbi who comes in Erev Rosh Hashanah and stands before the Yom Kippur, before the Aron Kodesh, and he says, Ribbono Shel Olam, it's Erev Rosh Hashanah now, and I'm a nothing, I'm a garnet, and you should know I'm a garnet, and I feel like a garnet, and he starts crying, and he breaks down, and the chazan comes in to see what's going on. He sees it, walks in also. He listens to what the rabbis say. He feels it's a good thing to say Erev Rosh Hashanah. After all, he's going to be davening in front of the omelet. He should also confess to being a nothing. So he starts, Ribbono Shel Olam, ich bin echet ha-gornit, and a bigger gornit than the rov, and I'm nothing, and I'm really absolutely nothing. The shamus is walking in the corridor, and he hears the geshrei going on in the shul. Goes in, he sees the rabbi crying and the chazan crying and going at this and going at that, and he doesn't know what's happening. He goes up and listens and he hears what's going on. He says, they're right, I've been so busy all day, I didn't think, but I have to do tshuva before Rosh Hashanah. So he goes there behind the chazan and he starts, Ribbono Shel Olam, what a gornit I am. The chazan hears this and taps the rabbi on the shoulder and says, look who's a gornit now. So yes, the Yetzer Hara is a garnet. But it's even less than a garnet. You know, in astronomy they've got these black holes. They're nothing, but they're so powerfully nothing that they attract so much light that you can't see them at all, if you know what I'm talking about. You can have something which is so much nothing that it becomes terribly distracted. This, the Yetzer Hara, is nothing. It's just, you're not looking properly. But to a Talmid Chacham not to look properly is a terrible thing. Goodness is the Talmid Chacham, is that what it was? I was battling against blindness. How did I manage? And Amoretz looks at his eyes, that all it was? Just a matter of looking a bit more carefully, so why didn't I look? He doesn't understand what goes into it. That's what the Yetzer Hara is, it's nothing. It's just not looking clearly enough. So to fight the Yetzer Hara with elephant guns is not going to work. And that's one of the big mistakes that most people make, even in Musar. If the Musar isn't figured out properly and isn't practiced properly, it doesn't help going and starting to kill the Yetzer Hara, to wipe him out. What are you wiping out? The problem is that it's wiped out already. The problem is that you're lacking something. You're lacking vision. And people say they're going to uproot the Yetzirah from out of them. What's there to uproot? The Yetzirah has uprooted your vision. You've got to build. You've got to restore yourself. You've got to revitalize yourself. It doesn't help trying to fight something which doesn't exist. Fight the fact that you can't see. That doesn't help. You've got to improve your vision. A blind man going around with a stick to try and hit the thing which is causing him not to see. Beating all over the place. So that's not why you can't see. Something in you that's causing you not to see. You've got to strengthen your vision, not weaken something outside of you. And we like to think that the Yetzirah is outside of us up there, and we're all going to go with our sticks and beat him. It's his fault that we're so miserable. Him. It's not us. He doesn't exist. It's only us. The Mishnah says, we're just about finished. In Pirkei Avos, Perek Dalet, Rabbi Yaakov says, Yofo shor achas b'tshuva ma'asim tovim b'olam hazeh mikol chayei olam haba, v'yofo shor achas shel keras ruach b'olam haba mikol chayei olam hazeh. I'll explain it to you now, but what I'm trying to get to is, let me translate it first. Rabbi Yaakov says, one moment of tshuva and ma'asim tovim in this world, in other words, one moment of living to your full potential in olam hazeh, is better than the whole of Olam Haba. It's a frightening statement to make. Here we are working for Olam Haba, and Rabbi Yaakov says, one moment, shor achas, that doesn't mean an hour, that means a moment, of correct living in this world, is more pleasurable than the entire world to come. Now let's get an idea of how pleasurable the Olam Haba is. We're going to measure here proportionally, let's know what we're talking about. It's all very well to say that one moment here is more pleasurable than the whole Olam Haba. And how pleasurable is the Olam Haba after all that? The Yofo Shah Acha Shel Keras Ruach Olam Haba. And one moment of pleasure in Olam Haba is better than Kol Chaya Olam Haza, better than all the pleasures of this world. That's what it is. On the surface it doesn't make sense, it seems to contradict, but it makes very good sense. Take all the pleasures of this world together. Think of what would give you the most pleasure. That you can live like a king and a queen without any of the responsibilities of a king and a queen. That you have as many servants as you want, as much money as you want, as much honor as you want. That the world is at your feet and you can just do what you want and you have free run of the place. Just imagine the greatest pleasure you possibly can. One moment in Olam Haba is worth more pleasure than all that. As one Rav quite correctly told me after he watched the royal wedding, he says, realize that even if they did all that for me, it wouldn't be worth one moment in Olam Haba. One moment in Olam Haba is going to be more pleasure, more honor, more glorious than that whole business, and a lot more. That's what Olam Haba is. And yet one moment of correct living in Olam Haba is worth more than the whole of Olam Haba. When we're dealing with scales that it's almost impossible to imagine. That makes me realize one thing, we're missing out on an awful lot. That's for sure. There's something we're not doing right. Rabbi Yaakov isn't trying to say this to mislead us, or to egg us on, he's talking from personal experience. That's how he lived. One moment in tshuva, ma'asim tovim, is greater than the whole of Olam Haba. And the Olam Haba is greater than all the pleasures of Olam Haba lumped together. Imagine then, if we used the same pleasure principle and we were able to get as much pleasure from our spiritual living as people get from their physical living, and we regarded our source of spiritual fulfillment also as a source of gratification, and we were careful not to damage that as we're careful not to damage our bodies or not to damage somebody who's bribed us. Why are we careful not to damage our bodies, but we're not careful not to damage our neshamas? Because we don't get nachas from our neshamas. We don't get pleasure from it. Our gratification comes from our bodies, not from our neshamas. Why won't we damage people who bribe us, but we will damage people who teach us or people who help us? Because they're not giving me nachas. I'm not getting the same kind of pleasure from them that I got from the 100 rand or the 500 rand or the 2 million rand that I got from that ganav. That's why it is. If we could only put into practice that Mishnah and start enjoying our spiritual existence, we would find it much easier to handle the Yetzer Hara. What's the Yetzer Hara going to do? It's going to blind us. Why is it blinding us? Because we don't want to lose gratification. But what's the source of our gratification now? Not our bodies. Now the source of gratification becomes our spiritual existence, our intellects, our neshamas, our ruchnis, our kedusha. That's what makes us excited. That's what turns us on. So why shouldn't we cause a bit of physical inconvenience in order to acquire great spiritual enjoyment? There's a din that also comes from this week's Sedra. We talk about a person who commits a murder by mistake has to go into one of the Arei Miklat. He has to go into one of the six cities. He's goyle. He has to run away into one of those cities, and he lives there for a long time. Person who murders by mistake. Talmid shegoyle le'ir miklat. What happens if a Talmid, boy is learning in yeshiva, and chas v'sholem, he runs somebody over in his motor car, so he has to go to the Ir Miklat. Megalin raboy imoy, we send his Rebbe with him. Shenemar v'chai. It says he must live in that city. Doesn't say he must die in the city, it says he must live. The only thing you're restricting is his freedom of movement. But everything else he has to have. He's to live a normal life. He has to have all his material comforts that he's used to. Everything that he's used to he has to have. Only limiting his physical movement. That's all. If you don't let the Rebbe go, then you're limiting his life. Aseiloi kedei sheyichye. Do to him, set him up in that city in a way where he can live. And listen to this in the Rambam. This is in Hilchus Ruteach Ushminat Nefesh. Halach is Perek Zayin Halach Aleph. This is not in the Rambam's book of philosophy. This is Halach. This is his book of law. Pure, unadulterated, scientific, rational law. V'chaye ba'alei chokhma u'mevakshea b'loi Talmud Torah. The lives of intellectuals and those who seek wisdom without learning Torah, kemiso chashudim, it's like death for them. V'chein harav shegolo megale yeshivoso yimei. And so a Rebbe who goes, the yeshiva follows him too. Hear what that Rambam is saying? That to an intellectual, to a Baal Chochma, to a man of wisdom, to a Talmid Chochma, the man we've been talking about, fighting the Yetzer Hara, living without learning is not living at all. And that's not a slogan to stick on your back window of your car. It's not just some... That's halacha. That's how it really is. That's the truth. If you don't feel it, you're not an intellect. If you don't feel it, you haven't learnt yet. That's the measure of learning, when you feel that your life without Torah kemiso chashuvin, you feel dead, unfulfilled, dissatisfied and empty. And nothing can make up for it. Then you're an intellectual. Then you're a Torah intellectual. Then you're a Talmid Chochma. Then one's making that kind of progress. But now we see the key to it. Do you want that pleasure that we're talking about in Pirkei Avos, that pleasure of one moment in this world? You've got to be alive. Can't be dead and get it. And we're not living. And the living has to come through the thrills of learning. And the thrills of learning are hard to get because it takes many years before you reach this level. So there's a lot of time of slogging. But one needs to be able to substitute one's desire for physical gratification with a desire for a more pleasant gratification still. And I'm talking in hedonistic levels. It's simply nicer. It's just more geschmack. It tastes better. Learning is more fun than anything else if one's learning creatively. I'll say again, it takes a long time to get there, and one goes through many ups and downs. And even when one's got there, there are days when one's up and there are days when one's down. But the sum total of the experience of involving oneself in learning, there is nothing like it in any hedonistic pleasure that is capable of being experienced on this world. There is nothing like it. And that's why it's considered wrong to let the Talmid go to the Miklat without his Rebbe. I'll ask you, as Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz in fact asks, and he says, no, let the Talmud go without his Rebbe. He can take his library, he can take his shas, and we'll set him up there in a very nice home with servants, and he can just do what he wants, and he can sit, and we'll give him lots of money, And he can sit and he can learn quietly all day. We'll even give him a chavrusa maybe, but not his Rebbe. Says Reb Chaim, that won't work. This element of learning that we're talking about, of chai, of living, of the learning becoming the most dramatically hedonistic experience of one's life, that can only be done together with your Rebbe. When you can argue with him, and you can talk with him, and you can hear his ideas, and you can live along with them, and you can develop them further, and you can question them, and you can analyze them. That's when there's a dynamic relationship, that's when it's living Torah, and that's when you feel alive. To sit and read this on Sina, or to sit and read the art scrolls, or to sit and learn Gemara on one's own, even if one is a Talmid Chacham, in a place where one is without one's Rebbe, that's not the same. No matter how much of a Talmid Chacham you are, the Rebbe goes with, because without the Rebbe, he's sitting there and it's Kemiso Chashuvim. Even then his learning doesn't have that same kind of thrill. In order to have that kind of thrill, it needs that kind of relationship. And that's really the method of fighting our friend the Yetzirah. If you want to avoid the blindness, don't go trying to shoot the elephant. If you want to avoid the blindness, find out what's making you blind. What's making you blind is simply a little bit of shochad. They're paying you a bit of cash under the table. What you've got to do is just have something more important than cash. That's all. Find that the cash is just irrelevant. It's a distraction. You've got something which is giving you much more pleasure still. So that it's pleasure against pleasure. You're dealing with the Yetzirah on his own grounds. And you say, why are you blinding me, Yetzirah? And you're saying, because I don't want to damage myself because of self-gratification. So you say to yourself, I want to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning. But it's uncomfortable, it's cold, it's miserable, I'm tired. So the Yetzirah starts working. So you go to bed with your big guns. You're going to shoot the Yetzirah. As you wake up and he stands there, you'll take out your cannons and you'll shoot him. And then you'll get up. Doesn't work. Why don't you want to get up? Because ultimately you enjoy lying in bed more than you enjoy learning. That's all it is. No big Yetzirah deal. It's just arithmetic. You prefer staying in bed to learning. So it becomes very hard, but you're an honest person and you decided you would get up. So you start looking, weighing up. And there are just one or two points you fail to see. After all, it's early in the morning and you're very tired and you just don't see it 100% clearly, and you figure out after all that it's the right thing to do to get another 2 hours sleep. And you go to sleep with a clear conscience that you've done the right thing. That's how the Yetzirah works. You haven't seen something. And the way to fight that little guy is not with a gun. The way to fight that little guy is to make sure that your learning brings you more pleasure than your sleeping, or than your eating, or than your playing, or whatever it is. And then you'll ask me finally, and what about areas of Yetzirah outside of learning? You want to eat something which isn't kosher, or you want to say something which isn't kosher, or you want to take something which isn't yours, whatever it is. How does the Yetzirah work? They're exactly the same. Learning on this level, but we're talking about in-depth learning. It doesn't help just to learn quantitatively. We're talking about real in-depth learning. Learning in a way where your learning becomes your pleasure. It's not just your learning that becomes your pleasure. You start developing the skill of spiritual hedonism. You learn how to enjoy ruchnis. You learn how to enjoy not doing averos, and you learn how to enjoy doing a mitzvah. You learn how to enjoy finding physical pleasure in them. Ordinary physical hedonistic pleasure in them. But the only way you can learn how to do that is through the learning process. Through finding the joy in the learning itself. I think that in the case of women there is a more direct method. I think that women have a natural ability to relate hedonistically to spirituality than men do. And I think that by working on the areas of the mitzvahs and seeking pleasure in them, don't do them as a drag. Decide you're going to have fun, decide you're going to enjoy them. And find the pleasure, understand the mitzvah as best you can. Analyze it as best you can. See its function. See what it does for people in general and what it does for you in particular. And relate to it nicely. And relate to it in a relaxed way, as if you're going to have fun. You know, half of the reason that people have fun when they go out on a Saturday night, other than coming to the shir, is not because it's such fun going out on a Saturday night. Number one, Saturday nights are no different to any other night. And number two, the kind of things they do, if you analyze them, are not really cause for such fun. Go into a dark room with flashing, glaring lights and people dressed all peculiarly jumping up and down the road on the floor to raucous noises. That's not really something which should make a person happy, but it does. And part of the reason that it does is because they decide it's going to before they go. They know. They're conditioned. They know that's what makes you happy. And that just, it's an association of ideas. They just hear the music as they're walking towards the place. And they just see the lights in the distance and they're already happy. That's it. They just connect up. Just do that with mitzvahs too. Just start associating mitzvah with pleasure, not with bind. And you'll start finding very quickly that they can be enjoyed. And soon you'll find that they can be fantastic. And ultimately you'll find that you wouldn't give them up for anything. And that's something which one has to achieve, and that's something for which one has to drive. Then one finds that the Yetzer Hara will just disappear into his rightful place of non-existence.